Welcome to Weekly with WIC, episode number 5. This week we're answering questions, all those questions that members of our community have posted on social media and or are contemplating and dialoguing within their own networks. Love Local is a weekly podcast to help our community stay informed and either off the watch list or to move us down in this new tiered system. We want to do this for our kids so that they can be in school and our businesses to remain open.
Welcome to Weekly with WIC. Hi, my name is Lindsay Miller, and I am a resident and a PA here in Tehama County, and I have the honor and privilege of spending some time with Dr. Wickenheiser, who is not only our Tehama County public health officer, but also a retired internal medicine physician with decades of experience and knowledge, deeply respected in our community, as well as deeply cares for our community. So we're honored to spend some time with him today. His patients over the years have fondly and lovingly called him Dr. WIC, which is why we named this segment Weekly with WIC. And the intention of this is to disseminate information and to provide resources for this current COVID-19 pandemic. So thank you again, Dr. WIC, for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Lindsay. This is always great to have another episode of Weekly with WIC. I'm hoping that people are enjoying them.
They are. That's what we're hearing from our community. And this week, we're just going to go through and answer specific questions that we've received from members in our community that have posted on social media, also questions that we're hearing from networking groups and local businesses. So we'll kind of give you a rapid fire. You ready?
Yes.
All right. So I will kind of break this up into different sections so it makes it easy for conversation and flow. But we, specifically when we talk about or hear about the vaccine, the COVID vaccine specifically, can you share any update or progress on it?
Yes, I can. Yesterday we had a meeting with the state, and 2 weeks before the state had a meeting with the CDC. We looked at all the vaccines that are potentially going to be available, and by note today, that one of the vaccines, their trial has been held up, and that's because an individual developed transverse myelitis, and that's inflammation of the spinal cord system. It's not clear whether that's due to the vaccine or not, but they elected to hold off on the trial. And I think that's important for people to understand because it shows that we're really concerned about safety of the vaccine. So in these human clinical trials, if anything like that shows, the first thing that happens is we'll stop the trial. They will do investigation to see if that's something that's happened because of the vaccine or independent of it. But I would point out in terms of our vaccine update the other day, the two candidates that are most likely to hit the market first, the first one is made by a company called Moderna. The second one is made by Pfizer. They're both messenger RNA vaccines. These are truly different types of vaccines than have ever been done before. But the nice thing about these vaccines is they skip a bunch of steps. And what I mean by that, when you get vaccinated, your body has to assimilate the vaccine, go through an inflammatory process, eventually make messenger RNA, and that messenger RNA that's made helps you develop immunity. These will bypass a lot of those steps, and so your body doesn't have to undergo all the inflammation and stuff that it does with a normal vaccine, and you achieve your end result quicker. So they seem to be very promising. They're given, one is given day one and then again day 29. The other one is given day one and again day 22. They have extreme temperature storage spectrum. One is a minus 20 and one is a minus 70. It has to be stored. They're in 10 dose vials and the doses have to be used up within 6 hours of being opened. Those are all kind of the technical aspects of it. Then how would we disseminate the vaccine and who would we give it to? In looking at everything, what's come up is the first people that will likely get it will be the essential healthcare workers. And the reason that they would be given the vaccine first is because, A, they're most likely to contract the disease in the course of their business, because even if as a healthcare professional, you are adhering to everything you should, there are times when you may have a lapse in your technique and you may be more exposed. So that's why the healthcare people. The second thing is that healthcare individuals, if they contract the disease because of their contact with other individuals they're taking care of who are sick, they have the potential to pass it on to them because they may be in that pre-symptomatic phase and pass it on. So if we vaccinate those individuals first, then we've essentially guaranteed our workforce to take care of us when we get sick. The second people to be vaccinated would be high-risk people. The high-risk people are traditionally thought as being the elderly individuals, those have chronic illnesses. However, what we're seeing in terms of this pandemic, the elderly individuals and those with chronic illnesses, they're staying at home, they're washing their hands, and they're socially distancing. So therefore, we're not seeing them as much as a risk as the people in the community that we've experienced. So when we look at how we would gauge that, we would probably go to that group next, and then after that, move forward. When would the vaccine be available? The vaccine looks like earliest it could be available will be the end of October or early November for those high-risk people. And then for the general public would occur probably in February of next year. That's the earliest it would occur. When we take a look at how much vaccine we would get and how much we need, you know, California has a population of over 40 million people. Based on the vaccine allocation, we would get one of every eight doses manufactured so that we definitely would have enough. Now, if we look at vaccines and vaccine safety, people are saying, well, they're rushing things. Things are much too fast. Well, the government's program, Operation Warp Speed, the thing that makes this different than normal vaccine trials is what the government's done is it's paid the manufacturers to manufacture the vaccine ahead of it being tested. So if the vaccine tends to be effective, then it's already manufactured and it's ready to distribute. That's totally different than what's been done in the past. Is you go through, you do your three phases of testing. After you've done all that, only then do you start setting up any manufacturing capabilities. And so that's the reason that the vaccine can come on sooner. And it's not, and we're not shortcutting in terms of safety. We're still doing all the safety, but we've just moved the manufacturing back. So that kind of sums up where we're at in terms of vaccine and how it will affect us in California and how it will affect us overall.
Okay, that was a tremendous update on the COVID vaccine. So to recap, because that was a lot of information, first and foremost, we have two vaccines that are in phase three trials.
Correct.
They haven't compromised safety.
Correct.
We are hoping to have something potentially by the end of October. That's their best case scenario. And your primary focus will be in terms of priority, healthcare workers and high risk population. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. And it's important to know that the high risk is based on what your local epidemiology says, not on what the epidemiology as a nation shows.
Okay, that's a good point. And there shouldn't be any concern about us as a community having enough access to the COVID vaccine.
Correct. That's correct.
And then lastly, we get a lot of question about if I get a flu vaccine, can I have a COVID vaccine, and can I have them at the same time, or do I need to space them out?
That's a good question, and the answer is nobody knows at this point in time, but I can tell you after our discussion with the state yesterday and the CDC, the recommendation is going to be at this point in time not to do them simultaneously. That's unfortunate because we're losing an opportunity when we have people together to be able to vaccinate them. But in terms of safety, and again, we have to stress safety, we don't know that it's safe to give them together. And so the recommendation currently is going to be that we will not give them at the same time. Now, Dependent on what happens with the remaining part of the trials, that information may change, but at this point in time, we would not give them at the same time.
Are they speculating when they would space those out potentially within maybe a few weeks apart?
So the recommendation would be probably about 2 weeks apart at this point in time.
So what, specifically somebody asked, what does a vaccine mean for a healthy person?
What the vaccine means for a healthy person, it's going to essentially give you the tools that your body needs to fight the virus when you come in contact with it. That's what it means for you, because you as a healthy person do not have those tools. That's why you need the vaccine.
The flu vaccine and the COVID vaccine specifically?
Both of them, and the flu vaccine's different. Your body probably does have some of those tools because it's been exposed to influenza before. So it's developed some of those immune tools, but maybe not the right ones. So by taking the flu vaccine, that helps bring you up to speed. But the COVID virus, it's novel, and so you really have no experience to it.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
You're listening to Love Local, a podcast series dedicated to fostering community engagement. During this season, we're focusing on COVID-19, and more specifically, information that will allow our kids to stay in school, reduce the positivity rate, keep our businesses open, and people working safely. This podcast is produced by Kate & Company in partnership with Expect More Tehama. To gain other valuable resources, visit expectmoretehama.com or follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Love Local.
So we'll kind of jump topic here and talk about masking. So another person in our community asked, while masking may protect us from spreading COVID, aren't we also hurting our immune system by not being exposed to other mild viruses that we're commonly exposed to that actually help us stay healthy?
The answer to that is no. We do know that if people wear masks, then they're less likely to have as many viruses. But let me ask you this. How many times do you have to get sick so you have the tools needed to protect yourself? You don't have to get sick over and over and over again. You know, we all know the little kids, the snotty-nosed kids who are sick all the time. In the end, are they any healthier than the kids who are not like that? The answer is no. So why subject yourself to keep getting sick when you don't need to?
So another question is, we see masks required indoors, but in the case of outdoor dining, are masks required or even helpful, and how to navigate that process of masking or not masking outdoors?
The governor's order was very clear. The governor's order basically said that if you're inside in your own space, then you don't need to mask if you're within your home or if you're in your vehicle. If, however, you're out in public where there are people around, you should mask. And the rationale for that is, even if you're outdoors, depending on how vocal you are when you talk, you know, where the wind's blowing and stuff, how much droplets you're spewing, what happens if you're this really vigorous talker and gesturing and, you know, the spit's flying and stuff like that. If you're that kind of person, obviously there's going to be more droplets. And we know that the droplets, as we talked about, they can go over 30 feet, depending on if somebody's screaming or singing or something like that. So the answer is, if you're out of doors eating, obviously when you're eating, you don't wear a mask. But those around you that aren't eating should really wear a mask, because it's the cumulative exposure, as we talked about before, to the droplets. So the less you expose yourself, the less likely you are to get the disease.
And can you talk about the science of masking? And just like you had talked about in previous week, with the droplet and the amount of distance, what are we exactly doing by masking as much as possible?
By masking as much as possible, you're preventing the droplets coming from your mouth spewing into the air. And so, again, it's protecting those around you. Now, if you're wearing an N95 mask, which is what we use in the hospital, that not only protects you from spewing out, but it also protects you from droplets that might come your way. So that's essentially how it works.
Okay, thank you for that. Now switching topics to testing. This is commonly discussed in our community and in the nation at great. A person asked, I had a required test for surgery. Should I retest?
First of all, the people that are having the required tests before surgery, they're to make sure that you don't have COVID-19, because the concern is if you're in the pre-symptomatic phase, you have COVID-19, somebody gives you anesthesia, you have a surgery, you're trying to recover from the surgery, your body's trying to heal, and now all of a sudden you're infected with COVID-19. So that's why that's done there. If a person's tested there and is negative, becomes symptomatic down the road, yes, you should be retested. It's helpful to know if you have the disease or don't have the disease. Do you need to be retested just for surveillance in the future? It's up to you. I mean, it very much varies from community, depending on the availability of testing and that sort of thing.
Okay. So it sounds like our county is being punished because healthy people aren't testing. Do you agree?
Well, that actually was the case until 2 weeks ago when the state modified the plan and we're now in the tier system. And we got word on Monday, Labor Day, that after discussion with all the health officers, we've had some input to the state over the last couple weeks. The smaller counties will no longer be penalized if we cannot do enough testing. In the same breath, we will not be rewarded if we do excessive testing. So for us, that actually means a lot, because when we look at the state average and you standardize it for a population of 100,000, we would have to do 240 tests just to meet that average. In order to get a positive effect, we would end up having to do almost 400 tests per 100,000, and there's just no way we'd be able to meet that kind of requirement. But now, we're not, like I said, we're not being punished for not doing as many. We think we've hit most of the population that wants to get tested, and now what we're seeing is people who are exposed and stuff who are coming to get tested in all types of circumstances like that.
So how are our results in Tehama County so much different than our surrounding counties?
Well, part of the reason that our information is different than the surrounding counties is we take a very aggressive approach to testing, contact tracing. So if you take a look at our numbers and say, for instance, we have a family gathering, we have one individual who is positive, we quarantine the whole family, our experience is that probably 95% of those individuals also become positive. We test all those people. As they become positive, our numbers reflect that. If you look at some of the counties, whether they be to the north of us, the east of us, the south of us, they may not take that same aggressive approach. So, for instance, if you see that they have 90 people on quarantine and yet their numbers only go up a few people a day, over a couple of weeks, then you know that they're not testing the people that they've quarantined. So the position that we've taken with the state is the fact that since we test everybody that's in quarantine or as many people as we can, then we're not being rewarded for that, we're being penalized. And the counties that don't do that, they're actually being rewarded because their numbers are lower. However, I would point out that even though we have higher numbers, we've been very aggressive at contact tracing and isolating those individuals, so we've stopped the spread. Our numbers may be higher, but we stopped the spread from each event. That doesn't help us in terms of the businesses and the tiered system based on the case number, but we have some discussion with the state, and hopefully we can have our data adjudicated so that we can go ahead and plead our case and get us out of the purple tier.
Great. So true or false, the more tests we have, the quicker we will move down into a tier that allows businesses to open or reopen.
A week ago, I would have said that's the case. But now, since we're no longer being penalized for not having as many tests, it probably will not make a difference. Because the requirements would be the tests that are positive and the testing positivity. It is true, however, that if you're not doing very many tests and all the tests that you have are positive, then your test positivity rate goes up. So that becomes a statistical way that you're literally shooting yourself in the foot. So if you don't do enough testing, it will hurt you. But doing lots and lots of testing is not going to benefit us anymore.
So this is truly another story of the Goldilocks. It's just right.
That's
not too hot,
correct.
And not too cold, just right. So thank you again, Dr. Wick, for your time. We sincerely appreciate it. And we hope that this will re-engage and unify our community to really focusing on the heart of the matter. And join us next week as we dive deeper into exploring more conversations with COVID-19, unpacking the data, diving a little bit further into updates, as well as demystifying some of the stories that we hear commonly circulating around. So thank you again for your time, and we'll see you next week with Weekly with Wick.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Love Local, believing that an engaged community is a vibrant community. This episode was brought to you in part by Expect More Tehama, Tehama County Public Health, and our friends at the Community Foundation of the North State. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and visit our website at expectmoretehama.com. Do you have a specific question related to this podcast? Send us an email to kate@expectmoretehama.com.